When we started planning, we would have never thought that the conference would attract such an audience and so much interest from everybody. And we are very, very amazed and honored to have so many inspiring speakers who agreed to come, and delighted to have you all in the audience. But then we watched the participants list growing long, and that was a twofold experience, because we really worried that not all of you would find seats. And we had long discussions on how to handle that problem. And then we said, okay, there are no alternative locations in Freiburg we could have booked for tonight and tomorrow that would have adequately seated you all. So we said, us in the organizing team, I think it was Miriam, who said, let's turn it into a crowded academic feminist party. And that's what we're going to do, and you're all invited to celebrate with us. We are very, very glad to have you all here. We hope for engaging discussions, and we warmly invite all of you to take part in them and ask your questions. And now, let me hand over to Friederike Schulte to introduce tonight's first speaker.
I'm glad that I can welcome our two Claires tonight and introduce the one American Claire Potter to you, a keynote speaker from the U.S. and from really my favorite university in the U.S., the New School in New York City, with, all of you are academics, with a history that's really relevant to German history as... It was also the so-called university in exile when many people fled in the 30s, like Hannah Arendt, Max Wertheimer, Erich Fromm, and others. And I think the New School has always been cutting edge when finding new intersections between different disciplines. And I think Claire Potter is a great example of that. She came straight from New York City with a little detour over the Black Forest yesterday. Thank you for being such a great sport. The train system is a little challenging. We organized a talk for you at our sister institute in Tübingen, and I heard that the audience was predominantly male.
Yes, that's true.
Which I thought is worth mentioning. Claire Potter has a top-notch East Coast education with a BA from Yale and an MA and a PhD from New York University. And since 2012, she's been a professor of history at the New School. And before that, she was a professor at Wesleyan University. I'll just name a few of her publications. She published numerous articles on the history of feminist and queer activism, on the new media and changing public spheres, on writing and teaching history. One of her books is War on Crime, Bandits, G-Men, and the Politics of Mass Culture. It was published by Rutgers University Press already in the late 90s. And another book she co-edited with Renee Romano, called Doing Recent History on Privacy, Copyright, Video Games, Institutional Review Boards, Activist Scholarship, and History That Talks Back, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2012. Claire Potter is also a committed blogger discussing issues of politics and academics. Her blog, The Tenured Radical, is located at the website Chronicle of Higher Education, and she also helped build and is part of the Humanities Action Lab at the New School for Public Engagement, which is where a digital humanities curriculum will be established in the next few years. And she's a co-director of outhistory.org, the LGBT history website. Claire Potter will speak about Andrea Dworkin's Queer Friendships, which should be really fascinating. And I'm very glad that we have a tenured radical here to speak to us as part of this conference, which is really about the intersection of academics and activism and of theory and practicability of feminism. I wish you all a really inspiring evening, input, and fruitful conversations. Welcome, Claire Potter.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Friederike. Thank you, Marie. Thank you, everybody who has been so kind. As the people I've talked to know, I've never been to Germany before. I'm actually a little embarrassed about this. But I'm having such a wonderful time and meeting so many great people that I will come back over and over and over again. German-American friendship lives in me. So this keynote is drawn from some research I'm doing on something called the sex wars in the United States feminism, where radical feminists split over pornography. And Andrea Dworkin, of course, was, with her collaborator, Catherine MacKinnon, the leaders of the anti-pornography movement, although it was actually a little more complicated than that. And it was a very grassroots movement. Actually, some of the anti-pornography groups survive today. But I wanted to focus on Dworkin because Dworkin presents a historical and intellectual problem, because really nobody's ever written much about her. There are a couple of critical books, but people talk about her. So you'll go into a classroom in the United States in U.S. feminism, and a student will say, "Oh yeah, the Dworkinites," and you'll say, "Well, have you ever read any Andrea Dworkin?" "No, I don't have to." So I got really interested in that, and I got really interested in Dworkin, and I've been working in her archive at the Schlesinger Library, and have, through her partner, John Stoltenberg, gotten access to a lot of really great stuff. In 2009, I was just beginning a set of oral histories about the struggle over pornography within second-wave feminism, otherwise known as the sex wars of the 1980s. My second interview was with radical feminist, scholar, and New York City lesbian activist Carla Jay. Jay, along with a group of writers and artists that included Andrea Dworkin, John Stoltenberg, Barbara Deming, Jane Gappin, Leah Fritz, and Grace Paley, had participated in some of the earliest feminist anti-pornography protests in the United States. These were primarily based in New York City and in California, mobilizing feminists against Deep Throat in 1975, and in 1976, a movie called Snuff, a low-budget splatter film that claimed to portray the orgiastic actual murder of a real woman. Because I had already listened to several interviews that Jay had done with Dworkin in the late 1970s, I asked whether she would answer a few questions about this prominent feminist who inspires strong responses in most people. Jay responded that she would and that they had been close friends. Those who have done oral history will understand that it can get very personal. If Jay were a less good-natured person, I would say she was gently warning me to watch my step when she said they had been close friends. People sometimes do send you a signal in an interview about where you may and may not go. Jay, as I was to learn, had remained friendly with nearly everyone in the movement, which is very unusual, except perhaps for T. Grace Atkinson, who she once tackled during a magazine sit-in when T. Grace Atkinson seemed to be on the verge of throwing a male editor of a magazine out the window. Jay's capacity to bridge differences also makes her an unusual figure on the post-women's liberation radical feminist left, where schisms and generally horrible personal attacks abounded long before the 1982 Barnard Conference in New York launched the most vicious phase of the sex wars. In every organization, you can see Carla Jay playing a mediating role, refusing to take sides with one group of comrades against another. Therefore, in a sense, it was not surprising that it was this woman whose capacity for friendship seemed to rise above politics who made me realize that I had entered my research with an enormous blind spot. It had never occurred to me that Andrea Dworkin had friends. That's right. Even though radical feminism was a place of intense attachments and it flies in the face of common sense, everyone has friends, right? It had never occurred to me to imagine Andrea Dworkin as a person with friends. Indeed, when I asked Carla Jay what she missed most about this fierce lesbian, a woman who attached searing language to the darkest thoughts you can think about misogynist violence, Jay responded without hesitation, her jokes. Andrea had a wonderful sense of humor. To paraphrase Dworkin's life partner, John Stoltenberg, this was a transformational moment in which I began to see this activist, the history she helped to make, and the networks of relationships in which she was embedded with new eyes. Plunging back into my research, evidence of Dworkin's capacity for friendship queer and embracing friendship was everywhere. But I had been so focused on intensity and political conflict surrounding anti-pornography feminism that I had never really seen these friendships. Jay's comment finally opened the door that every historian wants to walk through. I stepped past the reputation imagined and embellished by others to see Andrea Dworkin as a person. Now, I must digress ever so briefly and talk about the sex wars, that moment in North American feminism that brought us the Women Against Pornography March on Times Square in 1979, the Barnard Conference in 1982, the Minneapolis Civil Rights Anti-Pornography Ordinance written by Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon in 1983, and American Booksellers v. Hudnut in 1985. Ultimately, Andrea Dworkin and attorney Catherine MacKinnon's work also brought us the Canadian Supreme Court's decision in R.V. Butler in 1992 that embedded key features of the MacKinnon-Dworkin Ordinance in Canadian law and the battle over the Clare Short Law in England, which proposed to move the lads' mags onto the top shelf with pornography. So it's otherwise known as the top shelf campaign. And it keeps sort of making reappearances, doesn't it? Yeah. Radical feminism in the United States became quite bifurcated over pornography, although my research is starting to show that there were lots and lots of women in the middle who hated porn and also had serious concerns about freedom of speech. With feminist academics in the new academic women's studies programs playing a significant role on both sides of the movement. While there are still some anti-pornography feminists in academia, most prominently Catherine MacKinnon, and lots in community groups around the United States, the United Kingdom, and the British Commonwealth, pro-pornography feminists, some called themselves anti-censorship feminists, although that's controversial, scored a series of decisive victories in court as well as in the court of opinion in American universities. While all feminist academics are not pro-pornography, and I've met a number of women in my research who support the ordinance to this day, to be anti-pornography feminism is a consensus position in 2015, if that makes sense, all of those negatives. Rutledge's new Porn Studies Journal, which launched in March 2014, may be controversial in some quarters. Feminist sociologist Gail Dines, for example, detests it, but it's not controversial in women's gender, sexuality, and feminist studies departments. Arguably, the sex wars gave tremendous visibility to what was, in 1982, still called women's studies. And the impact of women's studies on scholarship more generally has played a role in shaping the intellectual and historical context, as well as the university spaces within which one encounters Andrea Dworkin and her voluminous body of work. The clash between anti- and pro-porn factions produced such a wealth of writing in the United States that it isn't surprising that so few scholars have tackled the history of the movement that, fairly or unfairly, came to define feminism in the 1980s. Just to give you a sketch, Andrea Dworkin alone wrote 7 books between 1980 and 1988. Her collaborator, Catherine MacKinnon, published 2, and a third in 1989. So in the 1980s alone, 2 women published 11 books about pornography, which is really kind of phenomenal. Pro-pornography women responded with hundreds of books and articles of their own. 2 major collections emerged from the Barnard Conference and a feminist seminar coordinated by pro-pornography feminist Ann Snitow at New York University. Ann Snitow is now one of my colleagues. Between 1983 and 1988. During the sex wars, feminist theory, as a practice, moved out of consciousness-raising groups and decisively into the university, where it became fodder for tenure cases rather than activism. Gail Rubin's article, Thinking Sex, Notes for a Radical Theory of the Politics of Sexuality, originally delivered at the Barnard Conference, while Dworkin and some Women Against Pornography activists picketed and catcalled outside, was published as an extended essay in 1984. It is probably the founding document of queer theory. Between them, Rubin, Cindy Patton, Lisa Dugan, Carol Vance, Amber Hollabaugh, Ann Snitow, and others established a principle that many younger scholars take for granted, that scholarly writing about sexuality was a feminist political act, one that could sustain feminism's viability as a radical movement in the face of not just anti-pornography feminism, but the anti-sex and anti-woman policies of the Reagan administration between 1980 and 1988. For many scholars who came of age in the feminist and queer worlds that the sex wars and then AIDS made, Andrea Dworkin came to personify what it meant to be anti-sex, to be humorless, unplayful, angry, and to tell other women what they should be ashamed of what turned them on. How Dworkin crafted her own public voice surely has a great deal to do with this, and it was a voice that continues to compel many feminist anti-pornography activists to this day. However, opponents who did not know her and had perhaps never met her tend to presume that the public Dworkin and the private Dworkin were one and the same, when in fact that is almost never the case with anybody. This has had a pervasive effect on Dworkin's memory. Witness my surprise when Carla J. reminisced about how much she missed Andrea's jokes. But attacks on Dworkin's politics, made through cruel attacks on her sexuality and her capacity for intimacy, have successfully obscured the ways that she actually changed conversations about sexuality in the United States. As a movement, anti-pornography feminism was far more successful than any pro-pornography feminist from that period or after would want to admit. It has had lasting effects, particularly on laws that address child pornography and international sex trafficking. This is because the battle between pro- and anti-pornography advocates had far more to it than whether it was okay or not okay to make and view certain kinds of erotica or to have sex in one way or another way. In the United States, anti-pornography activism strove to change laws, and it did, dozens of them. It changed criminal, civil, and family law, as well as First Amendment law, at the federal and state levels. It changed labor and workplace regulations that, although they did not eliminate porn, actually changed how the industry functioned and elevated women's power within it. It kept gender equality before the public after the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment in 1982. It produced discourses about consent and power that have shaped campus anti-rape politics in the United States ever since. And it asked stubborn questions about a rapidly changing, unregulated media landscape that privileged corporate interests over people. It's easy to forget, when I frame the feminist 1980s through these sweeping issues, that historical change is almost always moved by people, often people like Andrea Dworkin, who command the affection of thousands of activists, great and small, even as they are also despised by others. When we historians try to understand why difficult people are loved, it isn't a secret that many of us then become extremely, almost emotionally involved with them. I think it is what draws many of us to intense topics and intense, difficult people to begin with. It's a real challenge and one to be aware of, but one principle that I have believed since I was an undergraduate is that finding roots into a subject's inner life requires tapping into and cultivating empathy for that person, no matter who that person is. I think many feminist and queer scholars would agree with me. For example, I'm thinking about Blanche Wiesen Cook's multi-volume biography of Eleanor Roosevelt and Cook's impish delight during some of the early talks she gave from her research in producing an excellent imitation of Eleanor Roosevelt's nasal, breathy speech. Or recall the brilliant passage in the biography of lesbian prison reformer Miriam Van Waters, when Estelle Friedman explains the absence of love letters from another woman in the archive by recreating the searing moment when, during McCarthy's Lavender Scare, Miriam Van Waters burned these precious souvenirs one by one. However, revealing one's empathy becomes a fraught question when the object of one's scholarly devotion is not universally admired by one's own friends, or, as in the case of Andrea Dworkin or her brilliant collaborator Catherine MacKinnon, when she is openly reviled by many colleagues who I have known for decades, who I admire, and who mostly seem to admire me. Let me also say, in my book about anti-pornography feminism, I do not intend any great rereading of Andrea Dworkin's 11 books, 5 volumes of poetry, and numerous critical articles. Her writing speaks for itself, and filtering it for a contemporary audience does a kind of violence to a voice that she defended so strongly that she would not even permit her friend Gloria Steinem to edit it. But I do intend to reinterpret her reputation as a woman with no capacity for love, friendship, or intimacy, because that misunderstanding leads us astray from what was at stake in her work to begin with. It has fundamentally confused our view of who she was, and hence her importance to shaping the history of women, the history of feminism, and the history of global sexual politics. Carla J. gave me a great gift that day. Through her expression of friendship, she not only created the possibility for me to forge an empathetic relation with Andrea Dworkin's memory that I had not previously had access to, but she opened my eyes to the role that sexual reputation has played in producing the recent history of American feminism. Many, or most of you, may believe that you know Andrea Dworkin through her public campaigns to end violence against women, which many people viewed then and now as anti-erotic and coercive. In a nutshell, she viewed pornography as anti-erotic and coercive. The divide between the fictional you that I am addressing here today and the Andrea Dworkin that I am conjuring up in this talk might be that, in your head, you are thinking that with some exceptions, we believe that a defense of pornography is a defense of sexual, intellectual, and artistic freedom. And that porn, again, perhaps with exceptions, is either unimportant or fun. But Dworkin did not see the things you are checking off in your head as exceptions. Child pornography. Underpaid international sex workers, the new genre of revenge porn, photos of girls being raped circulated on social media, which is now a really big thing in the United States. She did not see these things as exceptions or aberrations. She saw them as constitutive of pornography and of sexual violence itself. Period. Full stop. Andrea saw things in black and white, Carla J. remembers. She would not compromise about anything, whether it was to wear different clothing, to be taken maybe more seriously by the media, or to change her hair, or to do this, or to do that. Andrea was Andrea, and she was absolutely fierce about that. When she believed something, she was adamant about it. Dworkin worked very hard to figure out what she thought about something, and when she was satisfied, she defended it completely. One of her central projects was to understand the ideological work of sexual pleasure under patriarchy, and why the phallocentric practice of fucking was the organizing logic of human eroticism. Fucking, she concluded in Intercourse, functioned in... Intercourse is one of her books, sorry. Functioned... fucking, she concluded in Intercourse, functioned as a central instrument and enforcer of gender power, and as such was inherently violent. It is an important and unexplored question, given how many human beings, particularly but not only men, do not like to be fucked, why so many critics found this to be an outlandish and fundamentally anti-erotic stance. But they did. And for those who are unfamiliar with Dworkin's work, this has tended to structure her reputation as having been a person who did not understand one form of intimate friendship, sex, or sexual pleasure at all. I think it is safe to say, from Dworkin's puzzled and hurt reactions to how her early books were received by other radical women, that she did not anticipate that her own work would be used against her in such an unbelievably personal way, particularly by feminists and particularly by lesbians. According to Jay, it was, quote, bewildering to her that most of the people who attacked her clearly had not read her books. It became clear as soon as you spoke to them, and you'd say, well, what about what she says in chapter 5 about this or that? People would say, but no, I didn't read the book, but I know what she thinks. Sexual reputation provides a crucial context for how certain kinds of evidence might be privileged in feminist historical practice and other information unsought, suppressed, or ignored. Andrea Dworkin's contemporaries were either passionately devoted to her or, I am sorry to say, dismissed her theories of sex as an entirely fictitious account of female eroticism, despite the fact that her views reflected her own and many other women's experience of sexual violence. I was recently asked to rewrite an essay for a major online resource that framed Dworkin as a troubled and unhappy person, dismissing the intellectual work that she labored over as a product of her own inner turmoil and psychological predispositions. This approach to Dworkin is an unedited commonplace in publications that might require more of authors writing about other people. Attacks on Dworkin's work are also often accompanied by expressions of intentional or unintentional contempt for her body, her sexuality, her medical history, and her emotional health. It is ironic that a woman whose first major work pioneered questions about how patriarchy worked through destructive representations of women's bodies and sexual reputations would suffer this indignity even after her death. Of course, all feminists, particularly those who spoke out against pornography in the United States, were routinely shamed and mocked through obscene representations of themselves. Dworkin sued Hustler over such a representation. Gloria Steinem was driven into a deep depression by a similar attack in which Al Goldstein invited his readers to, quote, pin the cock on the feminist and hung the mock centerfold of a naked Steinem on a newsstand outside the offices of Ms. Magazine. Nearly every prominent second-wave feminist suffered this indignity at least once. In addition to coping with their own anxiety over and anger about these attacks, feminists involved in anti-violence activisms also became sponges for the pain their supporters articulated. By the mid-1970s, victims of sexual violence had begun to tell their stories in increasing numbers, in consciousness-raising groups, in print, at speakouts, at battered women's shelters, and increasingly at conferences that set the agenda for the movement and for women's studies as a field. For anti-pornography feminists, this also meant receiving letters in the mail from strangers who had been raped, beaten, made victims of incest, and/or forced to triangulate pornography into their sex lives by their husbands. One form of queer friendship that Dworkin exemplified, I would argue, was to make herself available, however reluctantly, because she was actually a very shy person, to complete strangers, listening to their stories for hours on end. These were intense exchanges with abused women who believed, from her writings, that Dworkin was their friend and that they could trust her with their terror and pain. I mean, seriously, people would just stop her on the street in Greenwich Village and say, Andrea, you have to listen to my story. And she would talk to them for hours. As Carla J. pointed out to me, listening to these confessions, often in intimate settings, took a toll. After a talk given at a campus or women's center, as Carla J. said, the person who picks you up or takes you back to the airport often has an agenda of some horrible thing they want to tell you. They had to tell somebody, and poor Andrea, every time she went to a campus, that was her lot. As she got older, it was like the weight of the world was settling into her. It was horrible to have to hear those things. Stories J. heard about gay and lesbian people abused by their families were, she said, bad enough, but Andrea's were worse. Everybody told her these stories, Jay recalled, because you, Andrea, will understand. It was really, really hard for her to do that. I suspect that because Dworkin relied on speaking fees for a substantial portion of her income, these fleeting, painful, queer friendships were a structural aspect of her existence as a social person and as an intellectual. Being alone offered no relief, as the women used in pornography reached out to her beyond the page. Now that I'm doing research for this pornography book, Andrea Dworkin wrote in June 1978 to Gloria Steinem, I go through piles of books like a zombie, or wishing I were a zombie so that I wouldn't know how awful they were. Pornography had left her, as she said, numb beyond feeling, making it difficult to enjoy casual reading and interrupting her sleep with violent nightmares. In September, returning a copy-edited article for publication in Ms., Dworkin confessed that, quote, I had my first good night's sleep in a long time after it was done. I was still murdered a few times, but at last managed to fall asleep and stay asleep for more than a few hours. It was like a 2-week vacation. Insomnia and an inability to concentrate, particularly in one who loves reading, are, of course, classic signs of trauma. As a younger person, Dworkin had herself been raped and beaten by her husband, and she had prostituted herself to survive, something she once counseled another young woman never to do if she wanted to ever enjoy sex again. Her work created daily encounters with what we now call triggering experiences. Anti-violence activists of all kinds are persistently immersed in the thing that repels them, and Dworkin, an intense and thorough researcher, did not spare herself. Her view that pornography transformed human behavior may have had something to do with the fact that she felt herself changed by it. In her own words, it turned her into a zombie, leaving her numb. In another letter to Steinem, Dworkin apologized for sounding uncharacteristically, as she said, moronic, since I have spent the last half week analyzing a photograph captioned Beaver Hunters from Hustler and have just begun on Whip Chick, a book. I may be the only living person to have taken 9 pages of notes on Whip Chick, she noted, with characteristic humor. This takes its toll, so everything that comes out of me sounds slightly weird, at least to me. Prior to my interviews, I had been making my way through Andrea Dworkin's published work as well as her archives at the Schlesinger Library. Yet up until the moment Jay prefaced our conversation by privileging her love for Dworkin, I had not really thought seriously about how socially isolating and difficult Dworkin's labors might have been, and how deeply she must have needed her friends. I had never asked myself why the failures of loyalty and the fallings out, for example, with Adrienne Rich in 1979, that permeated radical feminism in the early 1980s, were so particularly painful for Dworkin. Others, Steinem, Susan Brown Miller, and Women Against Pornography organizer Dorchen Leithold, kind of shook them off and moved on. Andrea didn't. It is an obvious fact, but a rarely voiced one, that feminist writers didn't exactly have a workplace. They had collectives, they had consciousness-raising groups, but most, with the group Gloria Steinem assembled at Ms. in the 1970s, as an exception, worked alone. Today, they would all be on Facebook. In fact, a lot of them are on Facebook. But in the pre-internet era, and in decades when telephones charged for every call and the device itself might be beyond your means financially, the frequent exchanges of letters was a form of daily intimacy, creating a virtual space where feminists did their work and performed their friendships. Andrea Dworkin's letters have a shocking beauty to them, but they also contrast vividly with the harsh vocabulary and polemical style required to describe the world of pornography, rape, incest, and battering in her books and speeches. Letter writing was also important to her because her income, like that of Kate Millett and Shulamith Firestone, periodically dried up, often when she was in the midst of a major project, and she needed to cast her net widely in that network of friends to scrape together some cash. Although she occasionally had a salary, she never had health benefits or a pension. Her contribution to her and John Stoltenberg's shared household was in the form of modest and sometimes meager speaking and writing fees. One of her most memorable moments, the 1977 speech she gave to Women Against Violence in Pornography and Media's Take Back the Night March in San Francisco, paid $50. Letters kept Dworkin connected to a vast friendship network, one that also linked her to editors who might buy her work or persuade others to do so. Sometimes written during bouts of insomnia, they are vivid renderings of what she thought about every aspect of radical feminism and reflect her deep affection for the recipients. They reveal her deep capacity for love and for loyalty and her heartbreak when others failed her. Letters to dear friends all ended with the phrase, "Love, Andrea." She mostly typed, but always signed the letters with a fountain pen, leaving a bit of her person on each one. Dworkin was also extremely domestic. Her decades-long relationship with her intimate partner John Stoltenberg was, among other things, a lovingly queer friendship, crafted through their mutual aspiration to androgynous intimacy. This female-male pairing resembled a heterosexual relationship to some, but it was not. Upon Dworkin's death, Stoltenberg recalled for New York Magazine that upon meeting this vibrant woman in 1974, he was dazzled by her. He felt, quote, like we had walked off a cliff, and shortly afterwards realized that he couldn't live his life without her. To her publicist, Elaine Marks, Andrea Dworkin had confided after her first meeting with Stoltenberg, "I met someone, and it's a man." The relationship was nurtured in a circle of other feminist friendships that eventually included Catherine MacKinnon, who also became one of Dworkin's closest friends and her closest intellectual collaborator, and experienced a similar feeling of having been, and MacKinnon experienced a similar feeling of having been struck by lightning when she met Andrea for the first time. Some found it remarkable, offensive, or incredible that a lesbian and a gay man chose to face the world together at a moment when gay liberation was making it apparent how many queer people were actually living in marital closets. It really wasn't strange, but it was very unusual to be so purposeful and public about it. The Dworkin-Stoltenberg Alliance was also very queer in their refusal to provide a sexual or erotic explanation for themselves, as Robin Morgan and poet Ken Pitchford did by identifying themselves for at least a decade as bisexual. But if you listen to some of the confessions of passionate fag-dyke couplings that emerged from the ACT UP Oral History Project, Dworkin and Stoltenberg were also very ahead of their time in the intimacy that they forged through mutual political commitments. Their relationship was also unusually durable. Nearly every other radical feminist you can name from the 1970s and 1980s lost or left men as they committed more deeply to the movement, including Robin Morgan, who decided to drop her identification as bisexual and make her life with women in 1981. Stoltenberg and Dworkin's open relationship honored each other's right to human autonomy, a difficult act of friendship for many couples to navigate. As John put it in a letter to friends after Andrea's death, they had married legally in 1996, but told only family members because neither one of us wanted to be perceived and treated as man and wife, a presumptive property relation. As Carla J. recalls, Andrea defined herself as a lesbian. John defined himself as a gay man. He had other relationships while they were together. She had other relationships. The two drew closer together as the anti-violence activism in which both were engaged made them targets of animosity and scorn among other radical feminists and gay liberationists. As Susan Brownmiller recalled, Dworkin and Stoltenberg were very, very close, astonishingly close. Like the one time, two times, Andrea came to my house, she'd call John to say, "I'm here." And then she'd call him to say, "I'm leaving now." And I've seen that in other couples, but it was their relationship. She needed him. As Dworkin embarked on anti-pornography activism in the mid-1970s, her heterosexual past and her insistence that she could be in a lesbian and in a committed, loving relationship with Stoltenberg became another stain on her reputation within radical feminism, even a source of crude humor. Radical feminists worked hard to define proper sexual citizenship, as memoirs and position papers written in the 1960s and 70s show. And attacking an activist's sexual reputation was a common way of undermining her political authority as well. A reputation for fucking men, or fucking like a man, could hobble the ability to function in a movement where lesbianism, or political lesbianism, was sometimes seen as the purest form of feminist commitment. In Heresies No. 6, Andrea Dworkin reported that at a conference in 1977, she, quote, "had been trembling, more afraid to speak than I had ever been, in a room of 200 sister lesbians who accused her of political deviationism as a practicing bisexual." In that room, to answer the question, "Do you still fuck men?" with a no, as I did, was to betray my deepest convictions. I had given in to the Inquisitor, she wrote, and I felt ashamed. As Dworkin became an increasingly public figure after the publication of Woman Hating in 1974, some also interpreted her work as thinly veiled resentment of being, in their view, physically unattractive to men or women. The politics of size were already a tension within feminism. In 1974, the Fat Underground commandeered the stage at a major women's rally to protest feminism's failure to attend to boorish remarks about singer Cass Elliot's death. Andrea was very hurt by these attacks on her body and also on her sexuality, Carla J. said. I remember one early meeting I went to at the Women's Center on West 22nd Street, and there was a speak out, and they were attacking her. The basis of the attack was that she was there and she wasn't a lesbian. The harsh things that have been said and written about Andrea Dworkin, while they stem from genuine intellectual and political disagreements within radical feminism, were incubated in an atmosphere in which Dworkin became an object of personal ridicule. Despite her accomplishments and prodigious intellect, she was repeatedly and publicly caricatured because of her size, her appearance, her dress, her frizzy mane of hair, her preference for overalls, and the toll that age can take on all of our bodies. Academics who opposed Dworkin's campaign to end pornography undermined her reputation as a sexual theorist in the 1980s by inferring that, for the many reasons I have cited above, she had no reputable claim to understanding the erotic at all. Opponents went after her intellectual, sexual, and political reputation simultaneously, singling her out from a network of more powerful anti-pornography allies that included Gloria Steinem and Robin Morgan. By 1984, they were accusing Dworkin and other feminist anti-pornography activists of having become anti-sex conservative activists, a false charge that has had remarkable staying power. Bizarre bedfellows went the title of one retrospective on Dworkin's work written shortly after her death, Andrea Dworkin's Ideological Intercourse with the Right. Dworkin struck back in the only way she knew how, by refusing to be silent. But these mischaracterizations must have hurt. When I asked Susan Brown Miller in 2010 how she herself had responded to being characterized as having become an anti-sex conservative, she said, "There's no answer to it. You can't answer it. You cannot answer it." Similarly, it is a central insight of Andrea Dworkin's first path-breaking book, Woman Hating, that it is impossible for women to protect their sexual reputations under patriarchy, because it is through the destruction of sexual reputation, their reduction to the status of a thing, that they become women in the first place. Whether you agree with her analysis or not, Dworkin understood sex very well, and what she believed was that phallocentric heterosexuality, as it was currently practiced, was a primary barrier to human intimacy. An erect penis, in her mind, was always an invitation to violence, much as a gun was an invitation to murder. Fucking, she argued in Intercourse, was a, quote, loyalty test, an act of pure contempt, a form of patriarchal punishment that tore the skin from the body. Even men were not fully free from the burden of fucking, since they, and I quote, had an affirmative obligation to use the fuck to create and maintain a social system of power over women, a social and political system in which the fuck, regulated and restrained, kept women compliant, a sexually subjugated class. These words were written at the height of the feminist sex wars. They were a challenge to pornographers, to feminists who defended pornography, and to feminists developing a revived interest in incorporating phalluses into the lesbian erotic. Her radical feminist detractors, often lost in mockery of her appearance and overlooking Dworkin's unsurpassed ability to use the word fuck in any grammatical construction she chose, which is pretty impressive when you think about it, were unable to conceive of friendships that surpassed sex, intimacy without penetration, despite the fact that, as I argued earlier, this is what many people prefer. They also overlooked the theories of androgyny that Dworkin had elaborated throughout her life's work. Intimacy occurred, she argued, not through the perpetual reenactment of gender and power, but in the erotic potential of acts that linked humans to each other, as she wrote in Intercourse, allowing perhaps men to make love to women more as women did to each other. These points tend to be lost when we see Dworkin only through the ideas that circulate about her and not as her friends knew and understood her. Of course, obscuring another person's actual ideas is the point of ad hominem attacks. Dworkin's many critics have characterized her as, at best, intolerant of erotic tastes that were protected free speech, and at worst, of perpetuating anti-sex ideologies that gave feminist cover to a conservative culture war in the age of Reagan. That has taken a toll on how she is remembered, and my job as a historian is to get past a sexual reputation that Andrea Dworkin always rejected and understand her on her own terms. Although she never, to the best of my knowledge, called herself queer, I want others to see her as the queer woman immersed in queer friendships that she was. The mischaracterization of this activist's reputation undermines the history of anti-pornography feminism and pro-pornography feminism, a crucial aspect of the radical feminist movement whose historical connections to contemporary anti-rape politics is, as a consequence, also underrecognized. I want to imagine how our memories of Andrea Dworkin and her intellectual work on the violence of heterosexual intercourse might be different if they were produced not as a narrative about allies and enemies, but about a woman who did her work in a matrix of queer friendships and queer ideas, which held the potential for ethical and loving intimacy that a patriarchal sexual revolution had not yet produced. And sometimes, as I wrestle with her words and her work, I think that I may have become Andrea Dworkin's queerest friend of all. Thank you.